Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Indigenous communities and grassroots organizers stood up to voter suppression and long-term systemic injustices by turning out to vote in record numbers. According to High Country News, 60 to 90% of the Navajo Nation's roughly 67,000 eligible voters turned out for Joe Biden. And across Arizona, which comprises 22 tribes and the country's third highest population of indigenous people, tribal communities made up the bulk of Biden's base support. Arizona flipped blue for Biden, the first time the state voted for a Democratic presidential candidate since 1996. In Menominee County, Wisconsin, which overlaps the tribe's reservation, 82% of people voted for Biden. Native people showed up as many tribes are still struggling with the COVID crisis. So we'll talk about that on today's show. We will also talk about Joe Biden's plan for Indian Country. It includes investing in education and youth engagement, expanding economic opportunities. We're not sure what that means exactly, but we'll ask our guest today. Fulfilling federal trust and treaty obligations, directing the U.S. Department of Justice to fully investigate the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children, and more. Joining us today are three guests. Jordan James Harville is Cherokee and Choctaw and Chief of Staff of the nonpartisan group Vote America. Jordan worked with the Navajo Nation and community partners to get out the vote. Hi, Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you. Jade Begay is a member of the Diné and Taseka Pueblo tribes of New Mexico and the creative director of Indian Collective. It's NDN Collective. That's an organization dedicated to building indigenous power and sustainable solutions. Jade is also a member of the environmental network Indigenous Rising, and she hosts the podcast Sko Vote Den, which is slang for Let's Go Vote Then. Hi, Jade. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me. Great to have you.
Jacqueline De Leon is a member of the Eleta Pueblo and staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund. Jacqueline has helped lead field hearings across Indian Country on Native voting rights and has testified before Congress on these issues many times. She co-authored the report, Obstacles at Every Turn, Barriers to Political Participation Faced by Native American Voters. Hi, Jacqueline. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, happy to be here.
Well, great to have all of you. It's been such an intense and long 4 years. I just want to say congratulations on all of the amazing work that you've done in Indian Country. And I just wonder, how are you all doing right now? Because it's, like I said, it's been a difficult 4 years, especially for people living in Indian Country. Jacqueline, you've been doing so many interviews about your report, Obstacles at Every Turn. And I just wonder how you're feeling today.
Well, I think there's still a lot of work to be done. You know, I'm optimistic and hopeful about the incoming administration that has flagged that it intends to work with Indian Country. But I do know that there's still a large information gap between the needs that are facing Indian Country and the power brokers that exist. And so we're trying to fill that gap every day.
And what about you, Jade? You host this great podcast, Sko Vote Den, which is slang for Let's Go Vote Then. And you've been interviewing a number of Native people about sensitivities around the Native vote, which we'll talk about during today's show. I just wonder, you know, how are you doing now that the election is over?
Yeah, great question. Thank you so much. For me, you know, I come from a background of working around Indigenous rights and climate justice. So when it comes to those issues that I work on primarily, I am still really relieved and still trying to hold this sense of celebration and this sense of empowerment. The Native vote proved to be very powerful this year, and so did our organizing efforts. So I'm really proud of my community, in particular in Navajo Nation, and I'm just really excited about our organizing potential, you know, that we were able to demonstrate this year.
What about you, Jordan? You were on the ground working with the Navajo Nation and other community partners to get out the vote. How are you feeling now that the election's over?
I think the word that would summarize it is inspired. Working with some of the community partners and seeing Native communities really mobilize and meet the challenges that were kind of presented to them with the COVID epidemic. More than 3.5 times the amount of Native folks were infected with the COVID virus over white folks. And so this has really impacted communities hard. And trying to mobilize through those challenges, I think, was even harder. But really thankful for the community partners on the ground who really did the heavy lifting and built on the decades worth of kind of work to build this political power base in Indian country.
Can you talk, Jordan, about some of the organizing that went on? What was different this time around versus 2016? Talk about some of the great work that, people really took part in to ensure that the Native vote really broke records this time around.
I don't think that it would, it's easy enough to say that it was one thing, right? I think that on the ground, community members were doing things like, doing rides to the polls on horseback, right? Community partners, the neighbors were stepping up for neighbors, community leaders were stepping up to provide food and access. And, in like the Hopi and Navajo COVID Relief Fund, which is one of the partners that we worked with, not only was providing the intense level of mutual aid support that was needed on the reservation, because they were being, they were facing much greater challenges than just the ballot box. But we were able to work with partners like that to not only provide mutual aid, but then also to go above and beyond and then get them registered to vote and turn out as well. And so I think that those are kind of really promising developments. I think that Native peoples were, frustrated, rightfully so, with the Trump's administration's response to the COVID epidemic and pandemic and kind of the lack thereof. And so I think you see that in the turnout numbers from this year.
Mm. What would you add, Jade?
Yeah, as far as, efforts that made, I agree that, there's not one thing that made sure we were getting out the vote. It was definitely a multi-pronged approach. And I think that goes to show just the level of understanding of what the community's needs are. Each nation, each Indigenous nation has its own barriers, has its own mm-hmm. complexities when it comes to getting out the vote. In Navajo Nation, and I'll be speaking of that community in particular because that's my community, we have issues with, differentiating between precincts and voting precincts and chapters. So making that education very clear to our community, language barriers, overcoming language barriers, the Rural Arizona Project and Rural Utah Project did an amazing text support line where you could text and get phone numbers for support lines that were in different languages. That's a huge resource. And then from our standpoint at NDN Collective with our podcast, just breaking down some of the myths around voting too. I think there's a lot of, rightfully so, there's a lot of mistrust around this process and the federal government in general. So, breaking that myth that the Native vote doesn't matter, that was our big challenge. And, our goal with our podcast was to amplify the narrative that actually the Native vote holds a lot of power and can really influence both systems change and political change. And we're starting to see, how that plays out.
I read an interview you did with Grist, and you said that one of the goals of your podcast was to reach millennials and talk about how it's possible to be radical and stand for sovereignty and self-determination, but also participate in this process. Can you talk more about that? I think that's just really important.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting that. Back to what I was saying, there's there's a lot of complexity when it comes to voting in Indian country. It's not black and white. You know, like I mentioned, there's a lot of mistrust, rightfully so. Every treaty between the U.S. and indigenous native tribal nations has been broken. You know, we continue to see our rights violated by oil industry, by BLM, you know, pushing forward extractive industry. So when it comes to voting, when it comes to participating in a democratic process, you know, it's hard to believe that, you know, our voice counts, that at the end of the day, you know, our basic needs are going to be listened to and considered. So that's a reality in Indian country. And we need to promote, I think, as people who, you know, want, you know, people like myself who want to see democracy strengthened and want to see my people participating in a powerful way and at the table to make decisions about our communities. We need to honor both truths. We can be radical in the sense of, you know, uprooting these truths and these historical traumas, and we can be participating in democracy and showing up at the polls or participating in elections or, you know, pressuring our elected leaders. I think you need both to really advanced indigenous rights.
What would you add to that, Jacqueline? Because in your report, looking at the quote obstacles, we're talking about, you know, so many systemic issues that go, in many cases, go back to broken treaties. And so I think what Jade points out in the interview she did is just so important, that, you know, you can focus on sovereignty and self-determination, but also, you know, take part in the system and recognize the importance of voting. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, thanks so much. I really appreciate this conversation, and I really appreciate Jade and Jordan's just really important and task that they're undergoing on the ground of actually grappling with integrating Native American communities' sovereign tribal governments into the democratic experiment that is America. And I don't think that we've honestly done that as a country. We haven't actually recognized Native American sovereigns in our popular understanding of what composes America. And so we chafe against the system because we haven't had an honest reckoning. And I think that states recognize that Native Americans hold a tremendous amount of power and have historically disenfranchised Native Americans intentionally because they've been fearful of that power. And they've tied that directly to Native American sovereignty. So the message coming from states has been things like, you cannot vote because you are incompetent to vote, or you cannot vote unless you explicitly give up, you know, quote unquote, your savage ways. You have to, you know, disavow your native tribal affiliation in order to participate in American democracy. And so it's not surprising that now that those strains remain and that there's this feeling like Native Americans are incompatible with the American system. In fact, what's true, though, I want to emphasize, is that America is a country that's redemption is founded upon the idea that everybody, every citizen can have a say, that democracy means that Native Americans have a role and a place to play, and that they can be dual sovereigns. They can have Native American sovereignty and also be participate in the American system. And in fact, the best way to safeguard American sovereignty is through participation, is through electing representatives that understand that multiple governments are not incompatible. Just like you can have a state government and a federal government, you can have a tribal government and a federal government. And so, you know, really coming to terms with that is an important thing that hasn't actually been done. You know, and so I think I really commend Jade and Jordan for really grappling with those issues in a real way so that there can be a motivation in Indian country to participate in this American system.
Jacqueline De Leon is a member of the Eleta Pueblo and staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund. She co-authored the report, Obstacles at Every Turn, Barriers to Political Participation Faced by Native American Voters. And you can read the report. It's at yourcallradio.org. Jade Begay is a member of the Diné and the Siqua Pueblo Tribes of New Mexico and the creative director of NDN Collective. Jade hosts the podcast Go Vote Den, which is slang for Let's Go Vote Then. Jordan James Harville is Cherokee and Choctaw and chief of staff of the group Vote America. Jordan worked with the Navajo Nation and community partners to get out the vote. Indigenous communities really stood up to voter suppression and long-term systemic injustices by turning out to vote in record numbers. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. As we say on this show on a pretty regular basis, you often hear about the Latino vote, African-American vote, Asian vote, but it's so rare to hear about the Native vote, although it's definitely getting better thanks to Native writers and journalists and hosts, podcast hosts. And then, of course, on CNN, we'll talk about this later, Natives were referred to as, quote, something else. So if you have any questions for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to a caller. Let's go to Benjamin in Richmond. Hi, Benjamin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know, I've spent an entire career as an old white man studying the Indian cultures and how they've been treated. And as I moved to California, I was astounded to read Benjamin Madley's book on American genocide and to find out that there was a conscious and an intentional effort to kill as many Indians as possible during the period of the 1848 to 50, when Leland Stanford was governor of this state. And yet I've never heard anything. You talk about systemic racism and all of that, and I think those are words that float over people's heads. I don't think people in this state and in this country understand the level of devastation that the Indian culture has been subjected to, that rises to the same level, maybe not in extent, but certainly in intention and purpose of the active killing and trying to eradicate a group of people. And I don't know why that's not raised more. I have many times contacted Stanford University. I don't care if they change their name, but I at least want a plaque that recounts the history and so that people can know the truth of what has happened in this country. Every one of those broken treaties is on the back of a first effort to write legislation. Kill them anywhere you see them. And why isn't that talked about more? Why is that not brought to our attention? Why isn't there a campaign?
Well, Benjamin, thank you for calling in. We've had Benjamin Madley on the show, I believe, two or three times now, along with California Natives. It's a very difficult book to read. My great-grandmother was forced to go to boarding school in Northern California, and I had to put the book down several times because it was so intense. And you raise a point that we talk about pretty regularly on the show. Jordan, I mean, this is ongoing. It's the erasure of the true history of the country. Listening to Benjamin talk about this book, I was thinking about the Democratic National Convention and the historian John Meacham. They played like a 4 or 5 minute clip from him talking about the history of the country. Natives were not even mentioned. And I wondered, does anyone else even see this other than probably Native people? So it's just an ongoing conversation, and I just wonder how you think about these issues, Jordan.
Yeah, this is incredibly important, and I really appreciate the question. You know, I think that when you talk about the Native experience in America, it is one of erasure, and it's a one of systematic oppression. And, you know, we have a very long history starting from the founding and actually before the founding of this nation of genociding, Native peoples. And, you know, really it was only until about 60 years ago that Native people fully had the right to vote, in the United States. And truthfully, in even the last 10 and 20 years, that right to vote and that franchise to vote has been in question, because of voter suppression laws, because of the historical gerrymandering that's happened, because of, you know, county clerks that perhaps have racial issues themselves, or at least are not providing the resources that need to keep Native voters informed and engaged. So I think that that's an incredibly important question. And I think that looking, you can't talk about Native turnout without having these conversations about voter suppression and about the history of holding down our nation's first peoples. So having said that, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, we are still here. I think that Native peoples are building their own media and political infrastructure to make that case. And I think that, you know, for those here in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, you look to things just, you know, a few decades ago, like the occupation of Alcatraz, as examples of Native people staking their claim in America and saying that we are still here, and that we're going to continue to be here for decades to come.
Yeah. And if you want another book to read, Benjamin, Lenata Warjack, I forgot the name of her book, but I'll find it during break. She was part of the Indian Relocation Act, and she came to the Bay Area, and she, you know, connected with other young Native people from across the country, and they just did really incredible things. And she actually was part of the occupation of Alcatraz. And there's history in there that most people probably don't even know about San Francisco. So I'll find the title and I'll tell you the name of it after we come back from a quick break. But before we go to break, Jade, what would you add to this? Just this ongoing question about, you know, Natives missing from a little history lesson during the Democratic Convention to what our caller Benjamin talked about, just the fact that most people don't even know about genocide in California, let alone what happened in, you know, the rest of the country.
Yeah, I think it's a demonstration or a signal that, you know, the project to erase Native Americans was somewhat effective. And, you know, we know from studies and surveys such as the Reclaiming Native Truth Project, which I recommend people look into if you're a teacher, if you're a citizen. It's really important to, you know, learn about, you know, the biases and the invisibility that our communities are faced with. But yeah, erasure is very much real, and invisibility is the modern form of bias against Native peoples and Indigenous peoples in the U.S. You know, one learning from the Native Truth report, or Reclaiming Native Truth report, is that many Americans are not clear how that Native people still exist. Another finding was that a lot of judges and law clerks who were interviewed admitted to knowing little to nothing about tribal sovereignty or Indian law. So, you know, it's at all the levels. It's at the citizen level, and it's at the federal level. So, you know, I think the work that, you know, so many organizations are doing to visibilize our people, I think the work that is happening even in Hollywood, in the last 2 weeks or so, it was announced that Ava DuVernay is going to produce the first ever Native sitcom or show on NBC. Those are things that will continue to help visibilize our people, and I think, you know, hopefully advance both visibility, but also the recognition that we are here, that we, you know, are fighting for our dignity, for our sovereignty, self-determination. And then, you know, I think back to the whole conversation around voting. I think one of the things we need to continue to do is vote, show up during midterms and general elections. Just yesterday, I think, or maybe it was this week, Ventura County in California declared racism as a public health crisis. Hmm. And so these are interesting steps we're seeing across the country, or examples rather, models on how small communities are dealing with racism and white supremacy. And that work is driven by the people we elect. So really excited to keep mobilizing around the Native vote and exercising that force that we have.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and after the break, we'll get Jacqueline to also add her thoughts. Jade Begay is a member of the Diné and the Sika Pueblo Tribes of New Mexico, creative director of the NDN Collective, and host of the podcast Sko Vote Den, which is slang for Let's Go Vote Then. Jordan James Harville is Cherokee and Choctaw and chief of staff of Vote America. James worked with the Navajo Nation and community partners to get out the vote. Jacqueline De Leon is a member of the Eleta Pueblo and staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund. Jacqueline is co-author of the report Obstacles at Every Turn, Barriers to Political Participation Faced by Native American Voters. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the Native vote. Indigenous communities stood up to voter suppression and long-term systemic injustices by turning out to vote in record numbers. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Jordan James Harville is chief of staff of Vote America. Jade Begay is creative director of the NDN Collective and host of the podcast Sko Vote Den. And Jacqueline De Leon is staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund. Jacqueline, I wonder what you would like to add to this question about erasure. And I think about this a lot because I just found the name of Dr. Lineta Warjack's book. It's called Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. We interviewed her. You can find that show at yourcallradio.org, and I hope you can pick up her book. There's a new book coming out called How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America, edited by Sarah Sinclair. We're going to have Sarah on the show soon. So Jacqueline, it's such an interesting time because we're inundated with new books about natives. There's, you know, so much going on in the writing world with journalism, with podcasts like Jade's, which is so exciting. But at the same time, a lot of people just don't know basic information because it's still not really taught in schools, although it is in some cases. And, you know, like I mentioned that mini doc during the DNC, which was kind of about history of the country, and it didn't even mention natives. So I wonder how you think about these issues.
So I think that, I think Jade and Jordan already covered a lot of really good ground. The only thing I would add is, you know, my lens is through political participation because I work in voting rights. And I think it sort of encapsulates the problem and demonstrates the solution in that, you know, Native Americans are actively being, I think, not just suppressed from voting, but suppressed from the narrative, the contemporary narrative, and as, you know, as living and breathing and existing. I think that, you know, participation in the political system and seizing power is a way to force your way into the narrative. And I think that's what Native Americans are starting to do due to the good work on the ground by so many activists and so many young people, I think, that recognize that there's power there and that are looking to elevate their communities into the popular consciousness. And so when we have watershed moments like the turnout of the Navajo Nation in Arizona, you know, we appreciate the ability to highlight that, to say, hey, look, you know, Native Americans exist and that we're impactful and powerful. That's not to say that suppression isn't still ongoing. And for the story in In Arizona, there's also a comparable story in Montana about how, a lot of communities there were actively suppressing the Native vote, and how in some instances they're successful. And so I think that kind of narrative is twofold, but I'm really proud of the Native communities that are forcing their way into popular consciousness.
And Jacqueline, you're going in and out a bit. I'm not sure if that's your connection, but hopefully we can take care of that. It's not that bad, but just to let you know. So let's talk about solutions and what it will take to really press the Biden administration, you know, members of Congress, all the way down to local officials to take on some of these issues. Jordan, we did a show earlier this year with the Navajo Water Project. 1 in 3 Navajo homes do not have a tap or toilet. This is just horrific on many levels. And then you add COVID into this equation where you're, you know, obviously supposed to wash your hands as much as possible. Well, how can you do that when you don't have a tap? That to me needs to be at the top of the list just to ensure that people have access to clean water. So how do you translate what, for example, the Navajo Nation just did, came out in big numbers to ensuring that something like this gets attention and something is actually done about it?
Yes, and I'm sorry, you're actually breaking up a little bit as well, but I'm going to try to answer it the best that I can. Native households are 19 times more likely than white households to lack access to plumbing. And that's actually something that Biden acknowledged in his transition plan, which I think was really core to kind of elevating the issue in the first place. I think there are, in general, core infrastructure needs for tribal lands that they've been neglected for over a century now. As they got created, the administration after administration has kind of ignored the needs of Indian country. And we've gotten a little bit more attention in the last few years, but not much more. And so I think one of the things first and foremost that that Joe Biden can do to kind of forward Indian country is on one hand, I think, rise Native people to the positions where they can lead on these issues, like appointing a Native person to his cabinet. And on the second form, actually start to address and through block grants and all the different forms of funding that the federal government can provide, the infrastructure funding that will be needed for Native communities to build back, right? And to kind of deal with the COVID crisis in the best way that suits them. Because again, they're not a monolith and every region has kind of their own needs. But being able to appreciate that nuance, I think first and foremost is only going to be able to be accomplished if Native people are leading the charge.
Yes, exactly. Good point. Jade, what would you add?
Yeah, I think Jonathan covered it really well. I think, you know, we need, and I'll just speak on like a climate level to these issues in particular, because I work on them in my position and, in my background. So when it comes to like the climate crisis, having again, just building on what Jonathan was talking about, having people in leadership to make those decisions and know from life experience how to adapt, how to mitigate these big crises that we're facing. For instance, I think about Deb Haaland being in her role and being a Native woman who also is a mother, and having these people in positions where they know what it's like to care for a family with all of these barriers, all of these challenges in Indian country is really important for how we build solutions around, whether it's the pandemic or whether it's around the climate crisis. Right now, Deb Haaland is being vetted by the Biden administration to be nominated as the Secretary of the Interior. Mm-hmm. This is huge for so many reasons. The Department of Interior oversees the Bureau of Indian affairs, Indian education, and it would be the first time for a Native person to hold that role. So this could be really powerful in as far as seeing systems change and having someone from our communities lead and make decisions from a place of really understanding our communities.
Yes, and we talked about the importance of the Department of the Interior on Monday's show, if you missed that. The EPA gets most of the attention, as it should, but the Department of the Interior doesn't get as much, and it is as important as the EPA. So you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. Jacqueline, I think it is actually on our end, if I was skipping out a bit. So hopefully we can deal with that line. But I'm sorry if you're hearing us kind of go in and out. It might be on our end. Jacqueline, how do you translate where we are today to tangible changes? We talked a bit about water. You also point out in your report that over 90% of reservations lack access to broadband. And of course, this affects voting, but it affects issues across the board.
Yeah, so I think that there are deep-rooted injustices that exist in Indian country due to the lack of infrastructure. There's the overwhelming lack of access to broadband that has so many implications. We're seeing now, obviously, with COVID and the move to online learning, Native American students are just being totally left out and getting dropped out of their ability to learn during this crisis. Economic opportunity is also stifled due to the lack of broadband. And as states increasingly move to things like, registering to vote online and that sort of thing, Native Americans are being left out of that conversation as well. I don't think it takes a genius to think about all the ways in which internet impacts our modern daily life and how lack of that is just going to reverberate throughout Native communities and their ability to prosper. But besides just broadband, the condition of the roads is dismal in Indian country. Mm-hmm. If you have to vote in November during the winter and your road is a dirt road and you've got to travel 30 to 40 miles, you're literally unable to make that trip. Creating modern roads in Indian country is vital, water is vital, and the way that you do that is I think unremarkable. It's legislation that happens at a federal and state and county level. It's also has to do with the composition of counties in Indian country. We see time and time again that Native American communities are gerrymandered or put into their vote is diluted or compacted in such a way that they aren't able to wield political power at a local level. So things like infrastructure, county projects, road paving, those types of projects are skipped in Native communities because of the unfair ways in which their communities are allocated. So I think, grappling with those fundamental power inequities is important so that Native Americans can be recognized and as American citizens and can reap the benefits of being an American citizen. Hmm.
Jordan, on Joe Biden's website, it says the Biden-Harris plan for Indian country would include things like expanded broadband or wireless broadband to every Native American household. I mentioned a couple of other things, directing the U.S. DOJ to fully investigate the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children. How do Native communities plan to hold the Biden-Harris team accountable for these promises?
Well, I think, first and foremost at the ballot box, right? And I think we saw that this year in that Native communities are really placing trust in the promises that Joe Biden has made for Indian country. We've heard these types of promises before. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to come through on them, right? But I think that that's why having these early conversations, like such as appointing a Native person to the cabinet, demonstrates the value that Biden will be placing in Indian country, right? And so he has some early opportunities here to show us whether he's going to come through on the promises that were made. But I would say also that, you know, Native communities in general, I don't think that there is one unique voice on how to hold someone accountable in a position like this. I think visibility, I think calling, you know, calling out things in the press, elevating policy issues and continuing the phenomenal work that all of us here are doing today. I think that's exactly how we hold him accountable.
What would you add, Jade? Because these promises have been made before, but I'm hoping that something does change, especially when it comes to investigating the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children. What are you hearing from young people about holding the Biden administration accountable on these issues?
Yeah, I think we're faced with a you know, a really interesting and unique challenge, not just in the year to come, but over the course of the last 8 months or so, as far as the pandemic goes. You know, our typical ways of holding our elected leaders accountable, as far as, you know, direct action and, you know, classic and traditional organizing tactics, you know, we can't utilize those tactics anymore, those strategies, because a lot of them are, you know, require gathering and going to our elected leaders' offices. So I think we're met with, a new challenge of envisioning new models of organizing. And I think, you know, a lot of it is digital. Right now I think, and, you know, young folks, of course, that's a place where we thrive. And, you know, we're, as far as, you know, millennials and Gen Z, you know, we have a real call to be active on those places. So I think there's, opportunities to really figure out how we're gonna do that in the next few months, and also over the course of the next year. What I am very excited about at the moment is the work being done by the Sunrise Movement, who is a movement of youth organizing for climate justice and also for a Green New Deal. They recently launched the Climate Mandate, advocating for various elected leaders to lead in Biden's cabinet. And it's a really exciting selection of people. We're seeing some traction on some of the nominees from the Sunrise Movement. So I think paying attention to that is going to be exciting over the next couple months. Looking to on the ground mutual aid groups, you know, who are doing the work within their communities, really observing, you know, the lessons learned over the course of the pandemic and how we can build bridges between mutual aid groups and our elected leaders. You know, how are we creating ways to share these lessons so that elected leaders are really hearing, feedback from the front lines?
And when it comes to voting, Jacqueline, Joe Biden has promised to restore the Voting Rights Act and support the Native American Voting Rights Act by creating a Native Voting Rights Task Force, which he says would ensure equal access to registration and polling sites. What are your thoughts on this, and what are some of the changes you're hoping to see in the coming years, say before the 2022 election?
Yeah, so I think that The Native American Voting Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act are two pieces of legislation. And, you know, I think Joe Biden, as the president, supporting them is helpful. Whether or not they would actually be shepherded through and enacted, I think depends on the political appetite of, you know, either the House or the Senate. I think the House already passed the Voting Rights Act and NAVRA, but it's held up currently in the Senate. So I think a lot of whether or not those changes are enacted will depend upon, you know, action that's ultimately taken in the Senate. And so I do think that I don't necessarily anticipate those changes being made by 2022, but I'm hopeful that they might be.
Well, let's hear from a caller before we end. Let's go to Bradley. Hi, Bradley. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I wondered if there's been to hold the Biden administration and the county and the state governments, whether there's been a new development of Native community independent political formation of a political organization, so that, you know, when you need to turn to the Democrats for to make progress, you can. But when they end up doing nothing, whether the political organizing can go on independently in the community.
Yeah, thank you. It's happening with a number of organizations. Jordan, can you take that one first?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, one thing I'll say, and I always want to say this at the front, there's 573 federally recognized tribes, right? So there's, and many, many more state recognized and many, many more unrecognized. So there's not one unique voice, right? But what I will say is that yes, over the last few decades, what we've seen is this amazing explosion of civic groups that have been popping up to provide everything from mutual aid to addressing the really structural barriers to the vote. You know, we look at places like the Rural Arizona, Rural Utah Project, who led addressing work on the Navajo Nation. There is a lack of USPS recognized addresses, which makes it difficult to get registered to vote in the first place, right, to receive your mail. They've been doing the work with Google to try to address those and give USPS recognized addresses to folks on the reservation. You see things like the, you know, advancing of political leadership, groups like Indian Collective, which have been forever, groups like NARF, who've been around forever, fighting these fights for directions, right? There is an amazing explosion of civic participation from Indian country. And I don't see those groups going away soon. I think what we're seeing is we're coming to a cusp of political activism that we will see carried out over the next several years.
And Jordan, I was looking at your Twitter account. You write that I'm so inspired by the work of Native-led movement groups across the country. It's been a century in the making, but activists have set the stage for a real reckoning. And you talk about how you're just really excited about what comes next. So when you're talking to groups on the ground, I mean, COVID is just so, it's just really hit Indian country so hard. But how are groups planning to organize from here and, you know, really ensure that these issues stay at the forefront?
You know, I think that it's, you know, on one hand, it's a little unclear because there's, you know, there's kind of now a wait and see moment, right, to see if the Biden administration will begin reciprocating the conversations that had happened just a few months ago, right? I think that that's the first piece, but I don't think that Native people are waiting around. You know, you saw at the end of last year, the Frank Lemire Presidential Forum, which was one of the first times where we brought presidents to the table to say, or presidential candidates to the table to talk to them about issues affecting Indian country. So I think that there's a larger educational moment here and a moment to talk to Congress people and judges and the general public about that Native people are still here, that we're fighting, that we are, you know, preserving our rights and our lands and the work that our ancestors gave us. So yeah, I think I don't see anything coming from here, but I don't know the concrete next steps necessarily.
And Jade, we're almost out of time. Do you want to give a shout out to some of the groups that are doing this really important work in many cases outside of the sort of political establishment? I mean, there's the NDN Collective, there's the Red Nation, there's the Indigenous Environment. Do you remember the, I'm trying to remember the.
Yeah. So I think you're about to say the Indigenous Environmental Network.
Thank you. Yes.
Sure. Yeah, I can also respond to the question a bit. You know, NDN Collective built out the Land Back campaign or launched that campaign back in October on Indigenous Peoples Day. That is something I would encourage people to keep their eyes out, I think, out for and developments around that campaign. There's a growing conversation, not just, you know, within our communities on the city level, on the community level, but, you know, at the national level of truth, reconciliation, and reparations. And when it comes to reparations, I think, you know, we're seeing real action taken towards, you know, giving land back. That is something, you know, we're seeing all across the nation, whether it's tribes receiving, you know, plots of land, and then being able to figure out, you know, how is this land going to be stewarded? How are we going to do restoration on this territory? And exercise self-determination. So I think this is going to be a growing movement. So yeah, please go check out that campaign, again, led by NDN Collective. And you can learn more about that campaign at landback.org. In the moment right now, you know, there's a lot of concern and action being taken around what's happening up north around the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR. Trump is rushing to lease those parts of the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so I would look towards Native movement and also the Gwich'in Steering Committee, who have been leading that fight for decades. We need those lands permanently protected. And this is also another promise that Biden has made in his campaign. So, you know, yeah, it's right now we're, like Jordan mentioned, in kind of a holding pattern, waiting to see if these promises are kept. But we don't, you know, we're not going to let him, you know, enter the office without us already putting the pressure in the meantime and as we approach January 2022.
Well, thank you for bringing up Land Back, because we're going to do a show about that in the near future, and we'd love to have you back for that. Jade Begay is creative director of the NDN Collective. Check out her podcast, Go Vote Den. Jordan James Harville is chief of staff of Vote America, and Jacqueline DeLeon is staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund. Thank you all so much for joining us.